I think it's just important to remember that right now, there are 120 million Afro-descendants in Brazil. If Brazil was a country in Africa, it would be the second largest country just behind Nigeria. And there are 250 million Afro-descendants from Mexico all the way to Argentina. 250 million. So it's a lot of Afro-descendants in the Americas that they are so oppressed, so poor, so disenfranchised that their histories and their stories don't get to be told or seen in a significant way.
So, what is it that you love about being Black?
That's a great question, Nanny Keena. I love being Black because I'm different from everybody else. And the second reason, because Black people can do anything they set their minds to.
What I like about being Black is just freaking amazing. We are amazing.
Every day is a good day for breathing.
My favorite part about being Black is the originality.
I love being Black because I can put my hair into different shapes and sizes, and nobody can ever tell me how my hair can be.
I do like the food.
When people say Black girl magic, that's for real. That ain't just because we just want to say that. It's real. We magic.
We are so unique in everything that we know.
Go ahead, say it. Please say that.
Listen to my nanny podcast.
Please say Black.
Please say,
please stay Black.
Please say Black.
As I always was Black.
All right, Please Say Black. I am so excited that in our debut season, we have been able to speak to so many people who I think are impactful and a part of what I would name as the African diaspora. And my guest, my friend, Guido Mello, is with me today and is going to expand our consciousness, our awareness, our language. Like, I just feel like you are going to enlarge us in so many ways in this conversation. So Guido is someone who actually started, we connected online last year. They started to follow the Anti-Blackness Reader Project, and they reached out in such a sweet and thoughtful way to talk about how my work was impacting them. And I really appreciated that. And we've been building this friendship ever since. And Guido is an Afro-Brazilian Latinx multilingual author, poet, literary workshop facilitator who's living in Melbourne, Australia. I do not know how to say the indigenous name of that place. So I'm going to need you to fill that blank in for me, sir.
Nam.
Nam, okay. Down under, we shouldn't call it down under because that's actually not globally accurate, but in Australia. And you are a member of the Sweatshop Literacy Movement. You are a columnist. You are a writer. Again, I think I mentioned you're a poet. You're a contributor to Growing Up African in Australia, which was published in 2019. Racism, Stories of Fear, Hate, and Bigotry, that was published in 2021. You have written for Overland Magazine. Just, you have a whole resume that people could check out when this conversation is over. How are you doing, brother?
I'm good, sister. How are you?
You know, we are out here. Is there anything that I missed from your bio or your projects that you want to share with the listeners today?
Absolutely, yeah. So also for the last 4 years, I've been a member of Afro-Brazilian Resistance Group. It was a group created by a Black woman, a psychologist from Brazil called Kiki Rodriguez. And that group have been liberating for me. We, in Portuguese, we have a word called quilombo, right? So in some other Spanish Latin American names, it's also called palenques. But basically, a quilombo or a palenque is a place that Africans in the diaspora, in the Americas, would get together and form these groups of resistance outside of European or the white oppression. And Brazil specifically had the first quilombo in the Americas in the 1595. So in 1595, way before 1619 project, 26 years before, Brazil had already a group of Afro-Brazilians or Africans, really. They were Africans organizing resistance together with the indigenous peoples of Brazil. And that is, I consider that the first African kingdom outside of Africa or in the Americas, right? And that kingdom lasted for 100 years. It only got destroyed by the Portuguese with all their might. And I mean, they had to hire pirates from Holland, from Spain, from France, and use all the military power at the time to destroy that kingdom in the 1695. So it took 100 years for them to destroy. You know, they've been attempting to destroy since 1595, and it took them 100 years. So a quilombo is a place that in Brazil, we consider a place where Black people get together, right? You know, like it's a place that you go and it's a safe space. Before even safe space exists, before all these terminologies existed, there was the idea, right? The idea of us getting together since 1595 as a resistance group. And now in Australia, we have an Afro-Brazilian quilombo, which is the Afro-Brazilian resistance group, which I'm a member of.
Wow, that is amazing. And I'm excited about including more information in this episode's notes about that. And again, absolutely. I told y'all listeners that Guido would like expand your consciousness, and you've already started, and we haven't even got an entire conversation yet.
It's time for the Blackest Thing.
Made it out the neighborhood, made it to the pros. Head, shoulders, knees, toes. It's a triple crown. Something you don't know.
All right, so I've got to ask you, what is the blackest thing you've done recently? If you're like, yep, that is me being my blackest self. What's the most blackest thing you've done of late?
You know, I think you can't know who I am without knowing who my parents are, right? And who, where I come from. And I think my father passed away in 2017, but I think the blackest thing he always done for me was to be a Black father, right? To be there, you know, giving me everything he could, you know, and knowledge. And he's a believer. He was a believer. And he instilled that on me that, you know, cooking and look after the kids is, it's a beautiful thing. So I think the blackest thing I have done was, you know, spend time with my kids. I have three kids, age 4, a boy, age 9, a girl, and age 10, a boy. And I took them yesterday, Friday night in Australia to an athletics place. And in Australia, it's very rare, like 99%, 95% of the population is white. But this place is like in a suburb where most of the people are South Asians of Indian descent and Southeast Asians, you know. So it was really nice to be in a place, some Africans as well, of course, and even Indigenous Australians. So it's really nice to be in an environment. And I deliberately chose that place. So I have to drive a bit far because I live in an inner city, more white suburb, but I had to drive a bit far to get that. And I think that's the blackest thing I've done, to be there for my kids.
I love that. And I doubled down on your blackest thing because then you drove a distance so that your kids could be around other Black and brown people. And that's so correct. I would add that on top of your Black fathering, you also drove to be super Black. So I think that is amazing. And I love that as an answer. So I want to ask you a question because you've been so clear with me in your response to this. And I think other people can find a lot of value. You are very intentional about saying I'm Afro-Brazilian. Why is that so important for you to use that term, to be known, to be named in that way?
For almost 40 years of my life, I wanted to be Brazilian like all the Brazilians around me. And half of us are white as a nation. And in the middle classes, I was really low middle class, just one step off the project. Literally, my houses were, I was next to it. It wasn't a slum, but there was a slum in the neighborhood. So, and I wanted to be part of the Brazilians, you know, but when I say the Brazilians, I really meant the white ones, you know, and that's really, there's a terrible racist joke that people say in Brazil, but I think it really sort of brings some truth to it, which is like white people say, why does black people want to join the church? And the reason that they want to join the church is because they want to call white people brothers, right, or sisters. And I think that's that. There's this, the fact that we want to be called brothers and sisters by these white people. And when I was Brazilian, I think there was that. Like, I want to be Brazilian, right? I want to be like the white Brazilians. And I realized that politically that wasn't enough for me, right? I couldn't really find myself. Like, and there was constant conflict with these people, right? Especially here on as an expat or migrant in Australia, I constantly have conflict with the white Brazilians, but I insisted in being part of them. And I would do favors. I would shed my humanity. I would do anything to be considered one of them, anything at all. And it doesn't matter how much I tried, still, I wasn't one of them. And then out of desperation, out of completely disbelief, I lost completely my hoping in ever becoming one of them, when Kiki Rodriguez, the psychologist, launched these ideas. She said, listen, I got to start an idea. I need your help. I know you are a leader in the community, because I was a leader of the left, the white lefties, which is, you call the Democrats, whatever, like the white lefties, you know, and they were really violent. And one of the things that the white lefties made sure is that the leadership was still white, you know? They wanted black people around. You know, I was one of the 10 persons of the committee, but when I challenged for the presidency, they said no. And they almost fired me from the, they like ostracized me and then made all my suggestions irrelevant. At the same time, this showed up, Kiki showed up with this idea. I don't know, out of, you know, ancestral perception, or she felt an energy, but she came and said, Guido, I don't know if you're interested, but we're making this group happening. And this process was happening already on me. Like, I was already becoming kind of, the Afro-Brazilian was just really growing on me, but I wasn't able to voice, because these lefties, the Brazilian Democrats, they were really like, we are Brazilians, you know, these Afro-Brazilian separatists. You know, this is a narrative that I'm sure you could hear from Nancy Pelosi, you know?
Well, I was just about to say, it's so funny because I call my latest version of that is thrice Obamas, right? People who here in the United States are like, I would have voted for Barack Obama 3 times if I could have. But some of these same people are consistently not supporting community schools where Black and Brown students go. Mm-hmm. Who are in favor of local, regional, and national policies that consistently profit white folks, right? So we should not be confused that the liberal or the so-called progressive agenda is not still one that favors anti-Blackness.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. In fact, if you could eliminate, like, Thanos, all Republicans in the United States, I bet that tomorrow still black folk would be down, you know, because the white liberals would still be in power and they would be keeping a lot of their policies. And we, yes, we are allies of them circumstantially because we have no choice, literally, both in Brazil and in the United States. But I know exactly that Once we challenge for leadership, they put us down. Once we ask for a little bit more, they push us down. And we know that ultimately, we have to create our own power structures, right? Both in Brazil and the United States. So you asked me about being Afro-Brazilian. I think also I remember dealing with Africans in Australia, like from the continent. And when I was just Brazilian, I remember there was a big tension between me and them. And I started to introduce myself as Afro-Brazilian. I'm really well connected to the African community here. And I'm really big part. It's a really important movement. And it's not a lot of Brazilians, you know, I don't know if there's any Afro-Brazilians listening to this. I know a lot of Afro-Brazilians who resist to be Afro-Brazilians right now because historically in Brazil, again, different story than in the United States. In Brazil, there was a whitewash way to try to make sure that everyone was just Brazilian and race didn't matter and racial democracy, which is all fake and faux. And that really confused the minds of our people in South America. And in Latin America, it's even worse. I know a woman from Colombia, she's clearly indigenous, like undeniably indigenous, all the features. And when I asked her, she lives in Australia, when I asked her if she was indigenous, she said, no, I'm Spanish. So there's this denial. It's really sad. And it happens in the Latin American community, in the United States too, this denial of the roots because, you know, it's not profitable. In fact, I'm really questioning there's a lot of Black folk coming out of nowhere, a lot of Latinos coming out of nowhere. And as much as I welcome the change of heart and minds of these sad new Black folk, I always wonder if it wasn't profitable and fashionable if they would come. You know what? I was Black in 1976 when I was born, and I'll be Black when I die. I had no doubt about that. I just using different terminologies, even when I was just Brazilian, quotation marks, I was Black Brazilian. Just I wasn't, I didn't identify as Afro-Brazilian, but I was clearly Black.
Yeah. And this is where we get in like messy talk, right? I call it messy talk, and it's messy talk in the community. There are lots of hard conversations we don't have amongst each other because it's hard and it creates tension and creates discomfort. You know, there are people, and I'm going to be really clear, I am not a supporter of people gatekeeping Black folks. In an anti-Black world, we don't have time for that, right? Like, we just don't. But what I Correct. Do want to name, and I'm glad you brought this up, is people who get to, I call them, be strategically brown or strategically Black, right? Mm-hmm. People who have the ability, for whatever reasons, for lots of reasons, right? We could talk about phenotype, we could talk about their educational pedigree, we could talk about the neighborhoods or schools they go to, but for various reasons, a lot of people are able to be, you know, Edward Bonillo is someone who talks about this, be honorary white, people who are white adjacent, right? People who, for all of a wealth of a whole bunch of reasons, can be strategically Black or brown, meaning they can say, oh, I'm a brown person, or oh, I'm a Black person, but they can make a choice when they want to show up as Black or brown, but they can also make a choice when they don't want to. That's a very different lived experience than people who don't have a choice. So to your point, even if you were walking around, if you came to the United States and you were like, I'm Brazilian. Look, if your mouth is shut and you standing on the corner someplace, people don't care what your nationality is. You look Black, you know what I'm saying? So there's a component of this where we need to start having a lot of in-group conversations around, like, what does it mean to be racialized as Black and to have a lived experience as a Black person? That is not to take away from the people who, for whatever reasons, through, you know, lineage, through community, have this ancestral tie. And I think what's really interesting about Brazil, and I'm going to get you to speak more to this in a second, you know, I've spent a lot of my life in higher ed talking about race as an identity construction, as a social construct. And I would often name for my students in the United States, hey, y'all, race as a construct has material consequence in the United States, but it doesn't have the same consequence throughout the world. But when I would name places where the racial construct mattered, I would always name Brazil, right? And part of that is because we got the data that says up to 4 million Africans were enslaved in the country. That enslavement, chattel slavery, existed in Brazil for 300 years. 40% of the enslaved Africans brought to the Americas ended up in Brazil. And so it is that African lineage there that makes the racial construct matter there in ways that it won't matter in South Korea. You see what I'm saying? So can you speak to what it means to kind of experience having a Black identity in a place where people want to believe that ethnicity is the most important thing?
Yeah. So to add to what you said about Afro-Brazilian, so like slavery there lasts 350 years. It is the longest modern history slavery in the world.
Wait, we usually even say, longer than the United States?
Yeah, way longer. About almost 100 years longer.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, because it started in 1539 when yours started in 1619. So we're talking about 80 years and more, you know? And then ours finished in 1888 and yours finished, you know, in the 60s or whatever, in the Civil War, whatever, at the end. 1876, I think.
1860. Now you're making us be fake historians, but yeah. 1860s with the 13th Amendment being signed.
Fair. Okay. So we were the last slavery and the first slavery in the America. So that shows you 350 years. That's exactly the number. And we would like to think that we usually, the numbers we use, you say 4 million, the numbers we usually use there is 5 million. So we add one more million. That's the estimates. Because there was a lot of pirates. A lot of African slaves came from the Americas as well. So they already came from Spanish America. So we imported the slaves. After the end of slavery everywhere, Brazil kept slavery. So we kept bringing in slaves from Argentina, Peru, Colombia. So, you know, the numbers can surpass, way surpass the 5 million mark, right? And at the time, the population of white Portuguese was about 750,000. You know, for every white person, there would be five of us. It's so incredible. Like, can you imagine the violence that is required to control one for five of your population? It has to be indescribable violence. And that violence, that extreme violence, you know, like in the United States, I read Stamped by the Beginning by Brian Kennedy, and he described lashes, right? Of up to 400 lashes. And that was really cruel in the United States. In Brazil, I have documented books in my house right now that describe up to 1,000 lashes, right? So it was way more cruel, way more violent, because it needed to be, because in the United States, you were always the minority. That was not the case here. And for them to control that amount of people, and that exists today. So Black people could not vote until 1988. This is like the very last decade of the 20th century.
So that would also explain why people would lean so heavily even on that concept of I'm just Brazilian as a way to rhetorically separate themselves from the ancestry that is African. Because,
that's correct. Because it was so bad. I remember, again, growing up, I was always Black. I was African. My mom and my dad, they are clearly Black. But I know everyone that's just two shades lighter than me or whatever, or phenotype or noses, anything that I could get away, they would be silent. You know, I had this neighbor who his mom was white and his father was Black, and he would not talk about race. To this day, we never spoke. We're not friends, because he was really, anything he could do to get away from Blackness, he would do it. And But yeah, historically speaking, Brazil, it has this really terrible beginnings. And a lot of people forget that amount of wisdom that's coming out of Brazilians trying to understand African ancestry and the racial relations, but that unfortunately get lost in translation literally, because the knowledge that we write is in Portuguese, you know, and it doesn't reach the Anglophone word as much as maybe knowledge coming out from Australia would. And one of my main tasks, my main objectives in the future is to be able to bridge that gap more and more. I think it's really important that we could have conferences, but more exchanges of wisdom, because, you know, there are people like doing what you're doing, doing what a lot of people are, that just don't have a voice because they talk in a different language to a different demographic. I think it's just important to remember that right now there are 120 million Afro-descendants in Brazil. If Brazil was a country in Africa, it would be the second largest country just behind Nigeria. And there are 250 million Afro-descendants from Mexico all the way to Argentina. 250 million. So it's a lot of Afro-descendants in the Americas that they are so oppressed, so poor, so disenfranchised that their histories and their stories don't get to be told or seen in a significant way.
Who's ready for some Black history?
This is your Black History Moment.
You know, today we can say all the things that don't go right on Aretha Franklin's interwebs, but there's so much that goes well, right? And it's the fact that we are able to, across the digital stage, meet people that we would never talk to in like our real life. So here I am in the United States in the southern region. Here you are in Australia, and we're having this conversation in real time. And today in the United States, a Black woman was nominated for the Supreme Court. And so I am constantly reminded that Black history is being made daily, right? And so you are Black history. And so if I were to ask you, like, how are you Black history? I would love to hear your thoughts and reflections about that.
You know, I think it's really beautiful what the African Americans, the North African Americans do with the Black History Month. And I think it's really inspiring. And I think sort of inspired by that, we have our own African American History Month, or Afro-Brazilian History Month, which is in November. So in November, we celebrate the death of the leader, the final leader of the Quilombo in 1695. His name was Zumbi. Z-U-M-B-I, Zumbi, like a zombie, but it's like it's spelled Zumbi. And Zumbi was really, he's a symbol of resistance, right? Of Afro-Brazilian resistance. And I guess I'd like to say Afro-Latin American resistance. And in our history month, it's a month of awareness and reflection. Like, we observe from afar the African Americans doing the African History Month. And I think it's so beautiful. And I try to celebrate the African American one, the North American one, by observing and reading new things that I did not know. It is incredible, the wealth of knowledge that's hidden on purpose. You know, like the other day I saw on the internet that African Americans protested Gone with the Wind. And I never knew that, you know. And just knowing that there was a voice of, you know, discontent and dissent, you know, in the teens, in the 1910s, protesting that horrible movie, that horrible, hey, racist movie, I think is very important. I believe in history, especially now. It's a moment that we have to document our discontent, right? Recently, I wrote an article about Amilcar Brown, who was a leader in Abyssal, who actually was very influential on Paulo Freire, the Brazilian, white Brazilian thinker, pedagogue, really important man, Paulo Freire. However, like I argue on my piece that he was influenced by African thinking. Yes, yeah, so I think it's important that we document our discontent, that we document, if possible, our resistance, even if we're the single voice. Because one day, I never heard anything like anti-Blackness as eloquently and as clear as you put it. Even though as soon as you said it on that podcast, I understood it. I knew what you were talking about. I never heard of. By documenting, we might activate on other Blacks anywhere in the diaspora, because we are global Blacks now. We, you know, there's Africans in Singapore, China, you know, Belgium. There's Afro-Germans. There's Afro-Dutch. There's Afro-everything. We everywhere, you know, in New Zealand. So if we document this, someone in the future, 50, 100 years from now, can come and see that's what Kina Reed was saying. That was Guruwala was saying. And even though there wasn't many voices saying, there was some Black awareness. And you can figure from that one voice that, you know, he wouldn't be alone. There would be 10 or 20 or 100 of them. You know, maybe they just didn't have the vehicle, right? Once I became a writer, I'm 45 and I only start writing at 39, really. And I have a large family in Brazil, and an auntie of mine, a bit older than me, maybe she's just 50s, you know, and she came to me and said, write, and write some more, and write well, for you are our only voice. You're the voice of our family. I think that's the responsibility that we carry when we have these microphones that we have here, when we have the opportunity to write for big publications like I have done in the past and I'll continue doing in the future. I write with a responsibility and I don't know. Of course, there are white people doing that with responsibility, but you know, for most, for the average white writer there or white podcaster, they can just talk about games and nothing and not be interested in changing the world. Not that entertainment is not important, but that's not their responsibility, that weight that I can literally feel my shoulder by doing what I have to do. You know, I can't not attempt to change the world.
I love that. I mean, you're saying that you are Black history because you are documenting our discontent. And I just think that's a beautiful way to think about it. You know, I often think of myself as being a part of a cloud of witnesses. And someone, I don't even remember who I was talking to the other day, but they were like, oh, wow, Kina, I liked what you said. That was so phenomenal. I can't even remember because I say so much stuff all the time. But whatever it was, my response was, I'm glad you appreciated it. But I want to be really clear. I'm not saying something that my ancestors didn't say. Oh, I know what I said. I said something along the lines of, you know, one of the things I've been saying, and I've been really careful about saying it publicly, is that I no longer plan to use the term microaggressions. There's nothing micro about the aggressions. It's racial terrorism. And we need to start using that term. Stop saying micro. It's not micro. It is big, big. All right. It has big impacts. It's racial terrorism. And so someone said, that is so great. You know, no one has ever said that. I said, I'm not saying anything Ida B. Wells didn't say when she was reporting about lynchings happening in this United States South. I said, I'm saying it maybe differently, you know, but this is not original to me. I'm a part of a large cloud of witnesses. And so I love that phrase. Like, we are making history. You are making history by documenting our discontent. And I feel like I need to tell myself a little bit here. When you mentioned Black people protesting Gone with the Wind, I want you to laugh at me. And if you need to cuss me out, you can. Because for the longest time, that was my favorite movie. It was, people would say, what's your favorite movie? And it was on the list. Okay. So, you know, I'm telling on myself. I'm in recovery. All right. I'm divesting from whiteness. I'm in recovery. I used to watch that movie all the time. And the last time I attempted to watch Gone with the Wind was 2020. And I got to the scene where Scarlett O'Hara slaps Mammy because Mammy doesn't know anything about birthing no babies. And I said, okay, I can never watch this movie again. It's time for me to hang it up, right? Now, a side note is, I actually think that Margaret Atwood, who is the white woman who wrote that book, I'm not convinced that at this point, she didn't steal that story from a Black person. But you know what? I don't have the receipts for that, okay? Yeah. But, you know, I just wanted you to laugh at me that I watched the movie you just talked about on several occasions.
No, but I would not do that. I think, like, we got immersed into this reality, right? And I think the beautiful thing about Black folk is that we try to see humanity on everyone, including white people. We see the humanity. And there is a human story behind Gone with the Wind. That's a beautiful story. The problem is that the racial tension and the racial background story that's hidden, you know, they're fighting for the Civil War. Yes. Like, that's the problem. The beautiful story that you saw, that I saw, I think I used to like Gone with the Wind too, right? It's not, you're not as late, and I don't think we should be embarrassed by this. I think, like, Fight Club, like, which is a white supremacist incel movie film. Yeah. Like, I like that too, that you can go on and on and on.
Incel.
Yeah, Fight Club is incel. Absolutely incel.
I never thought about that. Damn, you are so right.
Yeah, it's an incel movie. You know, like, the guy's trying to, like, it's a white supremacist movie.
It's a white supremacist incel movie. But yeah, to your point,
he set up chapters in every, think about it. He set up chapters in every city of this group of ultra violence group trying to destroy society. Who will pay first if society collapses? Black people.
And, you know, even when you said that, we try to see the humanity in everyone. And part of that is because we are the origin of everyone's story. Right?
That's correct.
So of course we would see the humanity in everybody, because there would be no life without the continent, African people, you know? And so we are the origin story for all humanity. And of course we would see humanity in all people. We are the source of it.
That's correct. I read Yuval's Sapiens, right? And there's a moment, right? There's a specific moment where we stop being like this primates, and we really, okay, this is humankind. And the moment that he described is that we started to walk around the continent as humans, as Homo sapiens. And one of the things that we realized that we could do was to leave these coconuts filled with water. And we put this plant on it, and that plant, you know, that branch would signify that under that branch, there would be water. And we started to live for anyone. We started to live for family, but then we started to live for anyone. And that's the moment, really, that humanity is really born in a sort of symbolic way, right? Because we leave water for anyone, because we are them. They are us.
And you know, people could call me, don't call Guido, you could call me, email me if you're upset about this, but that's our origin story. Our origin story isn't caves. That's not our origin story.
No. Yeah.
Now, that might be some people's origin story, but that ain't mine.
This is it. This is the moment.
Yeah, I love that.
It's a beautiful moment. It's a beautiful moment in Homo sapiens history. And who were the Homo sapiens? They were Africans. They just look like you and I. They just look like you and I.
Yeah. So I've never thought about this until I just heard you cite that number. So when we include African Americans in North America, Afro-Mexicans in Mexico, which is a part of North America. So basically anyone who is a part of the diaspora in Americas, it looks like I'm calculating the numbers, but it seems like we're the majority. Is that not close to accurate? That we would be the majority of people across the Americas?
No, I think, I'm not sure. I think there's still more white people, but I think we would be close to 300 million if we are there. Because what are you guys, 50 million, 60 million?
No, we're 13 million in the United States. 13 million. 13 million in the United States.
So 250 million down south plus you. So 263 million if we added you folks. So, but there's still, you know, like in the United States alone, there's like hundreds of millions of white people. In down south, in Brazil, there's also 120 million white Brazilians. There's a lot of white people, man.
I see why you took the sail out of my skies. I was getting crunk over here. I was like, wow, we the majority up in this piece.
No, we can't.
We're not there yet. Okay. Thanks for keeping me honest. But I think what you shared also made me think about, you know, this week we honored the anniversary of Malcolm X's assassination. And at the end of his life, right, the tragic end of his life, we've seen a Malcolm that evolved. And this is a Malcolm, as far as I know, did not spend a lot of time, if ever, in Central America or South America or Brazil, but I know spent time in Europe, spent some time in Africa, in the Congo, and had gotten to this point where he was really trying to get people, again, across the African diaspora, to realize, like, look, there are these common struggles. There are common stories. There are common triumphs to be celebrated. And so there's this quote that he shared. And this brother, Malcolm X did more in the last week of his life than some people do their whole entire lifetime. All right. But he's speaking and he says, up to now, there have been Black people in France divided, Black people in England divided, Black people here in America divided. What divided us? Our lack of pride, our lack of racial identity, our lack of racial pride, our lack of cultural roots. We had nothing in common, but as the African nation got its independence and changed its image, we became proud of it. And to the same degree that we become proud of it, we begin to have something in common to that same degree. And so I really wanted to get your thoughts on that, right? Like, is that information, is that statement, is that something we still need as African descendants in 2022?
I think there's always some importance on everything that Malcolm said. There's many interpretations for what the reason, he's correct in saying that we are divided, but there's many interpretations for what are the reasons. In the Afro-Brazilian context is the one that I can speak more closely and more clearly, there's this element of survival that I would not discard. As I said, proximity to whiteness, ideological or physically, was rewarded with life, with spoils, any spoils. Distance or resistance to keep your own culture was punished severely. I remember growing up in because I was middle class, low middle class, very low middle class. I was in our white neighborhood and people resented us. People didn't want us to be there. Our existence was threatening for people. People really mean to us. Like, we were not allowed to buy, like, even though we live in a democratic place, we couldn't go and buy a property or have a car, because people would just stop us. They would just harass us. But I remember there was this other Black family who were very, I don't know if the word is integrated, but like very sympathetic to the whites and very apologetic, and they had better outcomes. I think this division comes out of survival in the Brazilian context. And I forgive my past brothers and sisters and cousins for their choices. Today, we have a better, a new chance to reunite. And I think it will take maybe 50, 100 years or more for us to step. I don't want to oversimplify the reason we are divided is because we lack racial pride or lack of cultural roots, like in Malcolm X's speech, because that's a conversation. But I think there's a humanity that we have to forget. Remember, when you have no choice or no chance of dignity, you will, and you have 8 kids or 5 kids and you need to eat and they need to eat, perhaps. And if people say you have to tap dance, maybe you're gonna tap dance.
I think that's really important. And, you know, that's something that I really articulate in my conversations, especially with people who are racialized as white. No, I always say race is a social construct. Terms like white, even black, were created, right, for the racial hierarchy, for supremacy culture. But the difference between, you know, folks who are racialized as white choosing to enfranchise and to, you know, to kind of like break ties with their ancestry to be united in whiteness versus African folks is those people who are racialized as white, they chose to assimilate so they can have a more favorable position. Africans were not given the decision. Our assimilation has always been about survival, right? So I always try to make that really clear, and I appreciate you saying that. All right, last question on the floor. And this one right here, I want so many people, I wish people had 5 ears to hear your response to this. What is the connection that needs to exist between Black folks in the United States and Black folks in Brazil or South America? Where are those connections? Where do they need to be for global Black liberation?
Yeah, I think what we are doing is a part of it. I think we need to have more conversations and more exchange of wisdom. I'm sure, you know, you from the south of the United States, I'm from the north of Brazil, and we have technologies of survival that we have inherited from our families that we can be exchanging like we are doing. But there's more, you know, in the literature, in the music, in the arts, in the culture, in the theater, you know, in the cooking, in all areas. You know, you eat gumbo, we eat okra, it's the same. We have this, we cook the same food. Like we have, you know, you say, you're quoting Malcolm X, I can quote Abdias do Nascimento, right? Who was writing in the 40s. You know, maybe Malcolm X even read him, who knows, I don't know. You know, like we have this resistance, you know, you had resistance, you know, like in the 1700s, you have that lady that did the train, the railway, under the railway. We had Zumbi doing the
kilombo. No, I can't let you call her the lady. I'm going to have to say Harriet Tubman. Apologize.
My apologies.
It's okay, but you know, look, I couldn't let you stop without saying the whole name of Moses, Harriet Moses Tubman.
No, it's important. It's just that, you know, like sometimes as an Afro-Brazilian, I lack all the cultural depth of knowing, you know, all names of all the people.
Well, and to be fair, I don't know the names of the people you're citing either, right? So this is such a rich conversation, you know?
Yeah. And I'm not going to pretend I know, or I think it's, I knew as soon as I said the name, but yeah. And I think that exchange is really important. And I think, like, if I had all the time in the world, all the money in the world, I would try to launch this series of podcasts across Latin American and African Americans, a series of books. There's so much that we could, you know, like there's this woman called Jamila Rero in Brazil, and she's talking about lugar de fala, which is like from where I speak as an Afro-Brazilian woman. And she created a series. You know, there's a book on recreational racism You know, I never have even heard of the expression in the United States, but in Brazil, people are talking about it. There's books about it. There's things that we know, you know, I think there's less exchanging. There's, you know, I think that's what is it could be the future for the 21st century. Utilize the internet, the ability to TikTok, to Instagram, to Facebook, to Zoom call. And I think you are really avant-garde here, Kina, like talking with me as an Afro-Brazilian. I feel honored to be able to be documenting this. And then hopefully someone in the future will be reading and know that, you know, there was some Afro-Brazilians talking to some African-Americans. It was happening. Maybe in a small scale, maybe it's just us, I don't know. But it is happening. And there's so much that we can exchange. And I'm looking forward to what's going to happen next.
This has been amazing. You gave us so many names and books to think about and consider. And I'm gonna pick up that mantle that you offered and say that I wholeheartedly take responsibility for as I return to myself as a Black person. And as I continuously heal from the internalized supremacy culture and anti-Blackness, I make space in my heart and in my mind for the totality of what being an African person means now. And so I think that that is not something, I mean, you said it easily and as beautiful as a poet could say it. I actually think for those of us who hold that burden in our heart, we need to take that so seriously that there's so many reasons why we've not, I don't think it's as simple as just like the language barriers, although that is very real. But again, you know, there's 265 million of us on the continent. And so it works for supremacy culture that we consistently don't know how to find ways to connect. And so I'm honored that we have found a way to connect. Hopefully it inspires. This is just a little seed that grows so many trees. So I'm thankful for you. I'm thankful to you. I'm sure that people will listen to this episode and need to know where to find you. So where do they need to find you at, brother?
So most people find me on GuidoMelo1 at Twitter or Afropolitan, and in the letters AU for Australia, so Afropolitan AU at Instagram. And if you Google GuidoMelo, you're gonna come across a lot of my pieces written in English and in Portuguese. That's a privilege that, you know, the universe has given me, my ability to write in two languages fluently. So I have pieces in Portuguese and in English. I was talking about my mother, my family, my origins, the histories that I know, you know, the adventures and misadventures of existing while Black and navigating this world as, you know, with this beautiful melanin and with this hair that's reaches for the sun every day and points up.
Look, I always tell people the bigger the hair, the closer you are to God.
That's it.
Thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you, Kina. Thanks for having me. Thanks, folks.
Thanks for listening to the Please Say Black podcast. And I am so excited to be your host, Joaquina Reed. I hope today's episode really connected to you in a deep way. And I want to encourage you to check out the episode notes. You can find out more information about me, how you can support our podcast, and of course, find out more information about our dope guests. Lastly, make sure you follow us over at Instagram at Please Say Black. I want to leave you with this blessing from our tremendous ancestor, Malcolm X, that says, I pray that God bless you in everything you do. I pray that you will grow intellectually so that you can understand the problems of the world and where you fit into it, into that world picture. And I pray that all the fear that has ever been in your heart will be taken out. So, stay black, and be blessed.
Now, if you don't mind, I would like to get a little rest now.
Catch y'all next time.